So I talked about the hindrances and the jhanas as found in the Samanyapala Sutta, the second discourse in the long discourses. Tonight, I'll give you the whole sutta. This will give you a sense of the jhanas in context. Now, I'm going to give you my version of the sutta. You should probably go home and read the real version, all right? This is a very good translation at suttacentral.net. But I'll give you what I got. Thus have I heard. Once the Buddha was living in Jivaka's mango grove with a company of 1,250 monks just outside the great city of Rajagaha. Now, Jivaka, who had given the mango grove to the Buddha to use as a monastery, was the royal physician in the court of King Ajatasattu, king of Magadha. The night that this story takes place was the night of the full moon, and King Ajatasattu was sitting on the upper terrace of his palace, surrounded by his ministers and other members of the court. And when the full moon rose, he uttered a joyful exclamation. Oh, what a beautiful night! Oh, what a wondrous night! Oh, what an auspicious night! Perhaps we could visit some recluse or Brahmin who could bring some peace to my mind. You see, King Ajatasattu had a very unpeaceful mind. This was because he had killed his father, good King Bimbisara. King Bimbisara was one of the Buddha's very first patrons. Actually, King Bimbisara met Siddhartha Gautama before he became the Buddha. Story goes that King Bimbisara was looking out of one of the upper windows of his palace, and he saw this recluse on alms round down below. But this recluse seemed different than other recluses. And so the king called some of his men over and said, "Follow that recluse, see where he goes, and then come back and tell me." So the king's men followed Siddhartha Gautama to a mountain just outside the city of Rajagaha, where there are many caves. It's a perfect place if you're a recluse to go meditate. And so, while two of the men kept an eye on where Siddhartha Gautama was, another went back and told the king. The king rode out in his chariot and then dismounted and went up to see Siddhartha Gautama. Learned his story, was so impressed that he offered him a ministerial position in the court of Magadha. But Siddhartha Gautama wasn't interested in politics. He wanted to know what to do about all the dukkha. He wanted to find some peace. So he politely declined. But King Bimbisara got him to promise that if he figured it out, he'd come back and tell him. And sure enough, 3 years after the Buddha's awakening, he did return to Rajagaha, and he gave a discourse to King Bimbisara, and King Bimbisara was established in the fruit of stream entry, meaning he attained the first level of awakening, and he became a patron of the Buddha. But King Bimbisara had a son, Prince Ajatasattu. And Prince Ajatasattu was a very ambitious man. He grew weary of waiting for his father to die and decided to take matters into his own hands. He strapped a dagger to his thigh and went sneaking into the king's private quarters, where he was promptly apprehended by the guards. They hauled Prince Ajatasattu up before the king, and they said, "Great king, we found your son sneaking into your private quarters, and he had this dagger strapped to his thigh." "Son, why were you sneaking into my private quarters with a dagger strapped to your thigh?"
"I was going to kill you, Dad."
Why do you want to kill me?"
"I want your kingdom."
"Why didn't you just say so? Here, you can be king." So he made him king right on the spot. But King Ajatasattu grew worried that his father was going to get bored with all that meditation stuff. Because you see, Bimbisara went off and started practicing meditation. If his father got bored with the meditation stuff, he might want his kingdom back. So he ordered his father thrown in the dungeon. He couldn't bring himself to order his father killed. He just cut off all his food. He did allow one visitor, the queen. When she would go see her husband, she would smear her body with honey, and the king could live by licking it off. When King Bimbisara wasn't dying, King Ajatasattu went to see. "Dad, how come you're not dead yet?" "Oh, when your mother comes to visit me, she smears her body with honey, and I live by licking it off." End of visits from the queen. But still, King Bimbisara wasn't dying, so King Ajatasattu ordered him tortured. And during the torturing, he died. The commentaries tell us that two messages arrived at the same time at the palace. The first message was that a son had been born to King Ajatasattu's queen. And for the first time, King Ajatasattu understood a father's love for his son. And he turned to his men and he said, "Release my father from the dungeon." And they gave him the second message, which was that his father was dead. From that night on, King Ajatasattu had terrible nightmares. He would no sooner fall asleep than he would wake up screaming. And of course his servants would rush in, great king, are you all right? I'm fine, go away, go away." And they'd go away and he'd fall asleep and have another nightmare. So, on this full moon night, the king has insomnia. And if the king can't sleep, nobody gets to sleep. So he's sitting on the upper terrace of his palace, and there's all the ministers and other members of the court. And he utters his joyful exclamation about wanting to see some recluse or Brahmin who could bring some peace to his mind. And immediately, one of the ministers spoke up and said, "There's Purunakasapa. He's long gone forth. He has many followers. He is esteemed as holy. You should visit him. Perhaps he can bring some peace to your mind." The king said nothing. Another minister said, "There's Makaligosala. He's long gone forth. He has many followers. He's esteemed as holy. Perhaps," you get the picture. Each minister would champion his recluse or Brahmin. But all the while, the king said nothing. Eventually, after it all calmed down, the king turned to Jivaka, who was sitting nearby. "Jivaka, do you know any recluse or Brahmin we might visit who could bring some peace to my mind?" "Great king, the Buddha, the perfectly enlightened one, is living in my mango grove with a company of 1,250 monks. He teaches the Dhamma, which is good in the beginning, good in the middle, good in the end. You should visit the Buddha, great king. Perhaps he can bring some peace to your mind." "Prepare the elephant vehicles, Jivaka." So Jivaka goes running down from the upper terrace of the palace, down to the stables below, and he has 500 female elephants saddled up, along with the king's royal bull elephant. And then he runs back up to the upper terrace of the palace and he says, "The elephant vehicles are prepared, great king. Do as you say fit." So the king had 500 women of the court seated on each of the 500 elephants. And then the king and Jivaka mounted up on the royal tusker, the king's royal bull elephant, and they rode forth in full royal splendor with torchbearers going before. It must have been quite a sight on that full moon night. They rode out of the new city of Rajagaha, through the old city, and out to the city gates, and hung a left and headed towards the mango grove. But when they got near the mango grove, it was quiet. It was a little too quiet. "Jivaka, are you betraying me? Are you turning me over to my enemies?" "No, no, great king. Why would you think that? You said there's 1,250 people in this mango grove. I don't hear a sound. They're probably all meditating, great king. Look, you can see lights in the pavilion hall. Go forward, great king, go forward. So they went as far as they could go on the elephants, and then they dismounted, the king and Jivaka and the 500 women of the court. And they went up to the pavilion hall. The king is looking around, and he says, now, which one's the Buddha? He's sitting at the back, facing everybody else. And the king checks out the scene. He's quite impressed. All these monks sitting there, meditating very quietly, not even looking up when he and all these other people show up. And eventually, he's standing fairly near the Buddha, and he says, oh, if only my son, the prince, could experience peace such as this. And the Buddha heard him and said, great king, do your thoughts follow your affection? Indeed they do, venerable sir, indeed they do. I love my son the prince very much, and it would be wonderful if he could experience peace such as this. And then the king saluted the Buddha, saluted the company of monks, and sat down to one side. And sitting there, he said to the Buddha, venerable sir, may I ask you a question? Certainly, great king, ask whatever you wish. Venerable sir, in my kingdom, there are people who practice various crafts. There are elephant trainers, there are horse trainers. There are archers and spearmen. There are chainmail warriors, commandos, camp marshals. There are bakers, weavers, artisans of all sorts. There are street sweepers, barbers, accountants, statisticians. Each of them practices their craft, and it's possible to see some fruit of their labor, visible here and now. Venerable sir, can you point out any fruit of the spiritual life that is visible here and now? Great king, have you ever asked this question of any other recluses or Brahmins? Well, yes, actually I have, venerable sir. I've asked a half a dozen recluses and Brahmins about this matter, but each time they just preached their doctrine at me, they never really got around to answering the question. It was like asking for a mango and being given a breadfruit. It was not very satisfactory. So I ask you again, venerable sir, can you point out any fruit of the spiritual life visible here and now? Great king, I will ask you a question. Answer as you see fit. Suppose in your palace there's a workman, a slave, who arises before you each morning, sees that all of your needs are met, waits on you hand and foot from morning to night, and doesn't go to bed until after you go to bed. Suppose this slave were to think, it is wonderful, it is marvelous, the destiny of meritorious deeds. For this king Ajatasattu is a man and I am a man, and yet he enjoys the five strands of sense pleasure as though he were a god, while I wait on him hand and foot from morning to night. Perhaps I too should do meritorious deeds. Great king, suppose at some later time this slave were to shave off his hair and beard, put on the yellow robe, and go forth from the home life to the homeless life. Upon learning of this, would you send your men saying, make that man come back and be my slave? Oh, no, venerable sir. We would rise up before him. We would prepare a seat. We would see to his food, clothing, shelter, and medicinal requirements. We would provide for him righteous protection. Great king, is this not a fruit of the spiritual life visible here and now? Yes. Yes, indeed it is, venerable sir. Venerable sir, can you point out any fruit of the spiritual life different from this that's visible here and now? Great king, I will ask you a question. Answer as you see fit. Suppose in your kingdom there's a farmer who toils in his fields from morning to night. And when it's harvest time, He winds up paying a large portion of his harvest as taxes to support the royal treasury. Suppose this farmer were to grow weary of paying taxes. Suppose he were to think, "It is wonderful, it is marvelous, the destiny of meritorious deeds. For this King Ajatasattu is a man, and I am a man, and yet he enjoys the five strands of sense pleasures as though he were a god, while I toil in my fields from morning to night and then wind up paying a large portion of my harvest to support the royal treasury. Perhaps I too should do meritorious deeds." Great King, suppose at some later time this farmer were to shave off his hair and beard, leave the home life, go forth, putting on the yellow robe, to the homeless life. Upon hearing of this, would you send your man saying, "Make that man come back and be a farmer so he can support the royal treasury"? "Oh no, venerable sir, we would rise up before him. We would prepare a seat. We would see to his food, clothing, shelter, and medicinal requirements. We would provide for him righteous protection." Great King, is this not also a fruit of the spiritual life visible here and now? Yes, yes, venerable sir, it is. Venerable sir, can you point out any fruit of the spiritual life visible here and now, but more wondrous and more sublime than these? Listen, great King, and pay attention. A Tathagata arises in this world, a fully awakened Buddha, who teaches the Dhamma which is good in the beginning, good in the middle, good in the end. A householder or a householder's child or some other person hears the Dhamma and gains faith in the Tathagata, and at some point thinks, "Household life is crowded and dusty. Going forth is free like the air." And then at some point that householder, householder's child, or other person shaves off hair and beard, puts on the yellow robe, and goes forth from the home life to the homeless life. Great King, when one joins the Tathagata's order, one lives restrained by the precepts, the rules of behavior. We have many rules, Great King. The first of these is I undertake the training to refrain from killing living beings. The second one, I undertake the training to refrain from taking that which is not given. We are celibate. We tell the truth. We don't use harsh or abusive language. We try and be peacemakers rather than create division. We don't engage in gossip or idle chatter. We don't take intoxicants. We only eat during one part of the day. We don't adorn ourselves with jewelry or garlands or perfumes. We don't go to singing and dancing shows. We don't handle gold or silver. There are many rules, Great King. By keeping these rules, it makes it possible to live with the senses restrained. When one sees a sight with the eye, one does not grasp at the signs or secondary characteristics, lest evil, unwholesome states, such as covetousness or grief, overcome one. When one hears a sound with the ear, smells a smell with the nose, tastes a taste with the tongue, touches a texture with the body, or thinks a thought with the mind, one does not grasp at the signs or secondary characteristics, lest evil, unwholesome states such as covetousness or grief overcome one. When living with senses restrained, Great King, it makes it fairly easy to be mindful of all that we do, mindful when going forward and coming back, mindful when looking forward and looking back, mindful when getting dressed and going on alms round, mindful when eating and chewing, savoring and swallowing, mindful when going to the toilet, mindful when going to sleep and waking up, mindful when speaking and keeping silent. Also, Great King, we have very few needs. We're content with very little. All we need is food, clothing, shelter, and medicine if we're ill. This leaves us free to go wherever we want, like a bird on the wing. With these noble precepts, this noble guarding of the senses, this noble mindfulness, and this noble contentment, it makes it possible to do the work of a recluse. Having returned from alms round and eaten the midday meal, one goes to a secluded dwelling, the forest, the root of a tree, a hillside cave, a charnel ground, a heap of straw, the open air. One sits down cross-legged, holds one's body erect, and sets up mindfulness before oneself. Great King, when practicing meditation, there are five states that can rise that hinder progress on the spiritual path. The first of these is the desire for sensual gratification. Sense desire, Great King, is like being in debt. If someone is in debt, they must continually work to pay off that debt. But if someone in debt were to overcome that debt by paying it off, they would rejoice and become glad. In the same way, no sense desire is ultimately satisfying. It only leads to wanting more sense desires. But if someone can overcome sensual desire, even temporarily, one rejoices and becomes glad. The second of these hindrances, Great King, is ill will and hatred. Ill will and hatred is like being physically ill. If someone is physically ill, they don't feel well, they can't think straight, they're hot, they can't do what they want to do. If someone is ill, it's the same thing. Ill will and hatred is very much like being physically ill. But if someone was physically ill and were to take medicine and overcome that illness, they would rejoice and become glad. In the same way, if one can overcome ill will and hatred, even temporarily, one rejoices and becomes glad. The third of these hindrances, Great King, is sloth and torpor. Sloth and torpor is like being in prison. If someone is in a prison, they just sit there, missing out on all the good things of life. If someone is overcome with sloth and torpor, well, they might sit down to meditate, but they miss out on all the good things of spiritual life. But if a prisoner were to gain his freedom, he would rejoice and become glad. If one can overcome sloth and torpor, even temporarily, one rejoices and becomes glad. The fourth of these hindrances, Great King, is restlessness and remorse. Restlessness and remorse is like being a slave. A slave is always busy. Go there, do that. Come here, do this. But only doing what the master commands, not what the slave wants to do. It's the same with restlessness and remorse. One's mind is all over the place. One's body can't get settled. One can't actually practice the spiritual path. But if a slave were to gain his freedom, he would rejoice and become glad. In the same way, if one can overcome restlessness and remorse, even temporarily, one rejoices and becomes glad. The fifth of these hindrances, Great King, is skeptical doubt. Skeptical doubt is like being on a perilous desert journey where bandits abound and provisions are scarce. First one thinks to go in this direction, but no, there might be bandits. Then one thinks to go in that direction, but no, there won't be any water. One does more starting and stopping than actual progressing. It's the same with skeptical doubt. First one tries this practice, then that practice, never sticking with one long enough to see where it really leads. But if someone on a perilous desert journey were to arrive at a place of safety, they would rejoice and become glad. In the same way, if one can overcome skeptical doubt, even temporarily, one rejoices and becomes glad. Great King, when one sees that these five hindrances are not abandoned, one regards that as being in debt, as being physically ill, as being in prison, as being a slave, as a desert road. But when one sees that these five hindrances have been abandoned, one regards that as freedom from debt, as good health, as release from prison, as freedom from slavery, as a place of safety. Thus secluded from sense desires, secluded from unwholesome states of mind, one enters and remains in the first jhana, which is with thinking and examining, and is filled with rapture and happiness born of seclusion. One drenches deep, saturates, and suffuses one's body with the rapture and happiness born of seclusion, so that there is no part of one's body not filled with rapture and happiness. Great King, imagine a skilled bath attendant or his apprentice taking a metal basin and pouring in soap flakes and then just the right amount of water and mixing those soap flakes in that water until the soap flakes are pervaded with moisture, completely filled with moisture, encompassed with moisture, so that one has a homogeneous ball of soap that does not trickle. In the same way, one drenches deep, saturates, and suffuses one's body with the rapture and happiness born of seclusion, so that there is no part of one's body not filled with rapture and happiness. Great King, this is a fruit of the spiritual life, visible here and now, and more wondrous and more sublime than the previous. Further, Great King, with the subsiding of thinking and examining, by gaining inner tranquility and unification of mind, one enters and remains in the second jhana, which is without thinking and examining, and contains rapture and happiness born of concentration. One drenches deep, saturates, and suffuses one's body with the rapture and happiness born of concentration, so that there is no part of one's body not filled with rapture and happiness. Great King, imagine a lake far up in the mountains, where there are no streams coming in from the east, the west, the north, or the south, and there are not even any showers of rain. And yet, at the bottom of the lake, there's a spring of cool water that completely permeates the lake, so that no part of that lake is untouched by the cool water. In the same way, one drenches deep, saturates, and suffuses one's body with the rapture and happiness born of concentration, so that there is no part of one's body not filled with rapture and happiness. Great King, this too is a fruit of the spiritual life, visible here and now, and more wondrous and more sublime than the previous. Further, Great King, with the fading away of rapture, remaining imperturbable, mindful, and clearly aware, one enters and remains in the third jhana, of which the noble ones declare, happy is one who is equanimous and mindful. One drenches deep, saturates, and suffuses one's body with this happiness free from rapture, so there is no part of one's body not filled with happiness. Great King, imagine a lotus pond where there are blue, white, or red lotuses that grow up out of the mud but do not come above the surface of the water. They would lead their whole lives filled with water from their tips to their roots. In the same way, one drenches deep, saturates, and suffuses one's body with the happiness free from rapture, so there is no part of one's body not filled with happiness. Great King, this too is a fruit of the spiritual life, visible here and now, more wondrous and more sublime than the previous. Further, Great King, with the abandoning of pleasure and pain, and with the previous passing away of joy and grief, one enters and remains in the fourth jhana, a state beyond pleasure and pain that contains mindfulness fully purified by equanimity. One sits suffusing one's body with a pure, bright mind, so that there is no part of one's body not suffused by the pure, bright mind. Great King, imagine a man covered from the head down by a white cloth so that the cloth completely suffuses his body. In the same way, one sits suffusing one's body with a pure, bright mind, so there is no part of one's body not suffused by the pure, bright mind. Great King, this too is a fruit of the spiritual life, visible here and now, more wondrous and more sublime than the previous. Further, Great King, with a mind thus concentrated, clear, sharp, bright, malleable, wieldy, and given to imperturbability, one directs and inclines it to knowing and seeing. One understands thus This is my body, made of the four great elements, having material form, born of mother and father, fed on rice and gruel, impermanent, subject to rubbing and pressing, to dissolution and dispersion. And this is my consciousness, which is supported by it and bound up with it. Great King, insights into the nature of reality such as these are also fruits of the spiritual life, visible here and now, and more wondrous and more sublime than the previous. Further, Great King, with a mind thus concentrated, clear, sharp, bright, malleable, wieldy, and given to imperturbability, one can direct it and incline it to the various psychic powers. One can create a mind-made body. One can practice the various supernormal powers, such as walking on water, diving into the earth, passing through walls and ramparts unimpeded. Being one can become many. Being many, one can become one. One can appear and disappear at will. One can fly cross-legged through the air like a bird. One can wield mastery over the body as far as the Brahma realm. One can also hear sounds at a great distance. One can know the minds of others. One can remember past lives. One can see beings passing away and re-arising according to their karma. Great King, psychic powers like these are also fruits of the spiritual life, visible here and now, and more wondrous and more sublime than the previous. Further, Great King, with a mind thus concentrated, clear, sharp, bright, malleable, wieldy, and given to imperturbability, one can direct and incline it to overcoming the asavas, the intoxicants. One can understand this is dukkha. This is the origin of dukkha. This is the cessation of dukkha. This is the path of practice that leads to the cessation of dukkha. One can understand these are the asavas. This is the origin of the asavas. This is the cessation of the asavas. This is the path of practice that leads to the cessation of the asavas. And one can put an end to the asava of sense desire, the asava of becoming, the asava of ignorance. And making an end to these intoxicants leads to the complete ending of dukkha. Great King, this too is a fruit of the spiritual life, visible here and now, and more wondrous and more sublime than the previous. And furthermore, Great King, there is no fruit of the spiritual life more wondrous and more sublime than this. The king was impressed. Wonderful, marvelous. It's like setting up right something that's been knocked down. It's like pointing out the way to one who is lost. It's like bringing a lamp into a darkened room so that those who have eyes can see. I go for refuge to the Buddha and to the Bhikkhu Sangha and to the Dharma. May the Buddha please consider me a lay follower from this day forth. And then King Ajatasattu got all shamefaced, and finally he blurted out, "Venerable Sir, a transgression overcame me in that I killed my father, a righteous man and a righteous king." Indeed, a transgression did overcome you, Great King, in that you killed your father, a righteous man and a righteous king. But it is good that you admit such a transgression for the sake of your restraint in the future. Then King Ajatasattu said, "Well, we must be going. We have many things to do." "Do as you see fit, Great King." So the king saluted the Buddha, saluted the company of monks, circumambulated the Buddha, and then keeping the Buddha on his right, he and Jivaka and all the members of the court went back to where the elephants were parked, mounted up, and rode away back to the palace. And not long after the king was gone, the Buddha said to the monks, "This king has ruined himself. This king has destroyed himself. If he had not killed his father, a righteous man and a righteous king, the stainless eye of Dhamma would have opened in him tonight, and he would have attained the first level of awakening. But this king has ruined himself. This king has destroyed himself." And the monks were very pleased with all that the Buddha taught. Now the sutta ends here, but the commentaries go on to say that King Ajatasattu went back to his palace and had his first good night's sleep since his father died. And he did indeed become a great protector of the Dharma. 3 months after the Buddha's death, there was the first great council. 500 fully awakened disciples of the Buddha came together just outside the city of Rajagaha to recite the rules, the precepts for the monks and nuns, and to recite the suttas, the teachings of the Buddha, and basically lay the foundations of Buddhism. They obviously felt that this was a safe place for them to gather because they were under the protection of King Ajatasattu. King Ajatasattu was an ambitious man. After the Buddha's death, he set out on wars of conquest and conquered all of the neighboring kingdoms and built the nucleus of the first great Indian empire. But not all went well for King Ajatasattu. You see, his son killed him, and his grandson killed his son. And his great-grandson killed his grandson, and his great-great-grandson killed his great-grandson. And at that point, the people of Magadha said, "Enough of these father killers," and they killed the last of the line and installed a new dynasty.